Hello. Welcome to the Creative Shift Podcast. I'm Helga Henry. Join me in this space for conversation with entrepreneurs, intellects, business leaders and policymakers. Could you come over to my office, please? I've got some feedback for you. Now, even just listening to this, I would imagine, will make your liver flop or send you in a complete decline. Nobody ever thinks that feedback is going to be a good thing. And that's because, on the whole, I don't think it's actually given very well. So I'm going to give a couple of ideas and tips towards giving useful feedback. Feedback in its technical sense is error correcting information. If you think about feedback from a speaker when you're at a concert or something, all it really means is the microphone is too close to the speaker and you've just got to move it. The speaker's not wrong, nor's the microphone. It's just their relative positions. Feedback could and should be like that in a staff management situation, but it's never felt like that. At best, it feels like unwarranted meddling, maybe, and at worst, it just comes over as personal criticism. So that's my first tip, actually. Don't give opinion masquerading as feedback. Feedback is actually quite pure information. So if you didn't like something, that's not feedback. That's just opinion. If you didn't like something because it didn't hit certain criteria that you needed it to, focus on the criteria and what happened, and not your dislike. Another really top tip, when I learned about this, I was doing a course on facilitation at Henley Business School, and Jean Stewart, the woman who was leading it, went, you know, don't give feedback about things you can't change. So you're quite short, aren't you? Is not feedback. There's nothing that can be done about it. So there's not really any point in pointing that out. Also, avoid generic feedback. Well done. That was great. Excellent. Imagine you've just done a presentation. You've got various development points you've wanted to hit. You come off stage and your boss says, well done. Excellent. Well, what was excellent? All of it? Some of it? Did what you want to work on go better? Ideally, what you want to do when you give feedback is use what I call video language. Express what you could see and hear as the basis for your observations and comments. Focus on results. So, something like, I know you were trying to work on your nerves around your presentation today, and I could see that you've improved because your hands weren't shaking and your voice was steady and clear. That's really great feedback. It puts it in context and then gives the results and the basis for those results. So, what do you see and hear, and what do you think? A great way to evaluate yourself is to do the old three-pronged test. What went well? What went better this time than last time? And what do you want to work on next? That way, you have a framework within which to think about your progression and then also evaluate it. You can tell people that, and they can give you feedback within the same framework. So in summary, avoid disguising opinion as feedback. Don't give feedback about things that can't be changed. Avoid generic feedback, because it's not really feedback. Excellent or well done is not feedback. Use video language, what you can see and what you can hear, as the basis of your observations, and focus on the results that have been achieved. Carry out those tips, and the next time somebody says they have feedback, you won't be putting the fear of God into them. and they may even enjoy the conversation. So today on the Creative Shift podcast, I'm really delighted to welcome Mohammed Ali, Aerosol Arabic, to talk with us. I first came across Mohammed, in fact, I saw him on Newsnight when there was a piece about him doing some of his graffiti on the Stratford Road, and my friend Phil cut the news piece. But also then he was speaking at the TEDx Birmingham a couple of years ago that I hosted. And as a result of that, I looked at his other TEDx talks. He's done a marvellous one at Vatican City. And then most recently, he worked with us on the Birmingham Cathedral 300th anniversary. Mohammed, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've left various bits of your life and work out there. Do you want to fill in some of the gaps and tell the audience a little bit about your work and your practice?
I think primarily my work and what I'm perhaps known for is being a graffiti artist. A street artist, or whatever you want to call me, the labels there are for this, for the urban street art these days. But primarily growing up in the 80s, this is something that has been a big part of my life as far back as I can remember. And it was my journey into the creative industry. And I would never imagine that so many decades onwards now, being a father of three children, that I'd still be spray painting walls.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm making your living doing.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and traveling the world and painting and bringing color into public spaces. Mm-hmm. So primarily that was my craft, my passion for the spray can and the transformation that it can bring to urban spaces, and I've enjoyed doing that. And although that's what it started, and it kind of opened doors in many other areas, and I've kind of ventured into places where I didn't think I would be, you know, and I suppose my craft kind of broadened from that, I'm still engaged with the arts, and it's a big part of what I do.
So, starting off as a more, as it were, traditional graffiti artist, street artist, your career, I guess, has taken some shifts because now you're involved in a variety of other things. Mm. So, how did some of that come about? What was the progression there?
Sure. Going back to the kind of 90s, I guess, when I was studying art at school, and a school that I went to was a grammar school, and the arts department there wasn't the arts weren't particularly kind of encouraged that much in the school I was in. Well, it was, but, you know, it always had kind of the lowest budget, and it didn't have a massive uptake from the students when it came to choosing GCSE and A-level. And me as a graffiti artist as well, I was I'd say particularly discouraged at that point in terms of, you know, study the great masters, and, you know, this graffiti was kind of sneered at in a way,
marginalised in a subject that was already marginalised.
That's right, exactly, yeah, that's right, that's a good way of putting it. And you know, very different to today, when now street art is embraced by the arts world, and the Tates and Banksy kind of having a lot to do with that.
And it's big business as
well. Yeah, that's right, yeah. So at that time for me, I kind of, in some ways, rejected and I became very disillusioned with the traditional arts world, if you like. Mm-hmm. And as a street artist, growing up in the 80s and then, you know, studying in school, and my art being kind of not really being accepted in that, as I said, it was a bit of a backlash in a sense in that, sorry, not a backlash, but rather
rebellion.
Yeah, a rebellion, if you like, against the arts world. And it came to a point when it came to taking on the further going, continuing with my education, it was, well, what am I going to get out of a BA in fine art?
Yeah.
What am I going to now study? Where will that get me? What job will that give me? Mm-hmm. And I started to actually think about, well, what other, you know, what's the careers that I'm going to get out of being a painter, right? So what happened was I explored, and being from a family where even my own family perhaps didn't encourage me much in the arts, being from a family of immigrants that moved to the UK in the 60s, the arts were not encouraged for one reason, and perhaps this is something that many people perhaps don't have an insight into, and it simply was a case of what are you going to, what job can you get out of it? What are you going to make?
Well, that's right. Very similar. My family came from Ireland over in the 60s. And the arts were precarious.
Exactly.
That was the word you always got.
That's right.
Very precarious.
That's right.
Hard to make a living, hard to... You know, I guess if you've got strong family values, hard to provide for your family.
For family. And that's what was the driving force, really. Yeah. That was... Our parents weren't rejecting the arts for any other reason of, you know, being ignorant or whatever.
Or even not liking the arts.
It wasn't about that at all. It was just saying, son, we want you to have stability and get a good job. Yeah. And I'd probably say the same to my children now. If they chose to be artists, I would say the same thing. Are you sure you want to do this?
Yeah.
So I chose to do a degree in BA in multimedia design at the time.
Oh, okay.
Right. And this must have been about, 15 years ago now?
Yeah.
Because I thought, look, I can be a graphic designer. I can, this was my passion. Creativity was in my blood. I couldn't escape it. I realized, as much as my father would like me to be a doctor or a lawyer or a solicitor or whatever, I couldn't do it, And I was stuck with creativity.
Yeah.
That's all I knew. So I thought, okay, at the very least, if I'm going to be in this creative field, I'm going to try and get something that there's job prospects.
Yeah.
And multimedia at that time, that was the buzzword. I don't think they use this term anymore, multimedia.
Yeah.
But my degree, one of the few in the country at the time, exploring kind of animation and typography and video and sound, all of these different forms, led me to go into the computer games industry.
Wow.
So after graduating, I worked in the games industry for 5 years, making games. And if I'm honest, it was a dream job. It's something any kid, I talk to kids today. They're like, what? You made games and you left that industry, right? And that's what I did for 5 years. I worked in the games industry, designing the front-end graphics for some big names that kids would know today. If I told them, you could see my name at the end of those credits.
Wow.
All the front-end, everything you see when you enter the game from the menus, you select your player, you select your bike or your car and all of this stuff. All of that slick-looking stuff at the start of the game to entice you into the game is what was me, making it look good, making someone kind of draw into this world you'd created. After sitting behind a screen, surrounded by pizza boxes and things, all the clichés you imagine of a game studio, which is exactly how it was. It was brilliant, don't get me wrong. At the time, we were like, this is awesome, right, working in the games industry. But there came a point where I need to be out there in the world. I need to be talking to people. I need to be engaging. Yeah. I'm someone, I just felt this isn't me sitting here behind a screen. And also, not only that, part of me began to question what I was doing when I saw these, the gaming industry became this multi-million pound industry, huge industry. I began to question it and think, what am I doing? This skill, one skill I have, which is to be able to use color and composition and create this visual experience to do what? And I thought, no. And I suppose I went through this shift, if you like, where I began to question it. I had friends who were doctors and who'd studied all these other, went into these different fields, and they were able to, you could actually see the tangible benefits of what they did.
So see the difference they were making in the world.
In the world, exactly.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what do? I play, I play with colour and design and make games for a living.
Mm.
So there came a point where throughout my career in the commercial design industry, the arts was something that was still a big part of who I was. I was doing it in the background, if you like, in the side. Spray painting graffiti, that was something that I'd continue throughout. And I started, that was my real outlet for being creative, right? So on the side, that was something I'd continued. And more so, I found myself that was the outlet that really gave me the freedom it liberated me to say what I wanted to say.
So I was just about self-expression. I think it's a massive driver with me to help free up people's self-expression. Yeah. I think that's...
Mm.
Such a gift you could give to people in the world, actually.
And I suppose also because there was that kind of suppression as well, and I always think that when one suppresses something, when it comes to that point where you're able to just let it out, it really is like an explosion, a beautiful explosion where you can just say, this is me and I don't care if you, this is not something that you want. So in many forms, this suppression had existed within me, and I would say the creativity, I would say in terms of my identity, being the son of an immigrant in this society, even though I'm born and raised mm-hmm. in this country, and my identity was something that I would confidently say, this is home and I am yeah. from this society, that question mark around that and the yeah. discourse around immigrants and which we see so much of today.
Yeah.
Growing up in that period, I would say, as I was growing in this society where you kind of reflect on all of this, and the art I was creating became the perfect medium to explore that as well.
Yeah.
So that suppression of who I suppose to some extent, and it gets complicated here in terms of I have to kind of go in really into how I was brought up and then schools and how I, where I was at that time as a young, mm-hmm. young guy growing up in this society, in terms of suppressing a part of my identity that I felt I'd buried it and I'd tried to hide it. Let's
yeah.
be honest.
Yeah.
And that is something that really, again, through creativity, that was coming, I was able to let that go and yeah. be out there. And that makes a big part of, has a big effect on how I express myself today, because it really is my kind of in-your-face approach of what are the issues when I deal with them is because of that, is because I was tired of burying something and suppressing something and concealing it, where now I say, this is what I do and what, this is who I am and what, you know, and I think that, so.
So, sorry, one of the things we like to make connections with is confidence. So it sounds to me like once you unleashed that inner voice, that self-expression, once you found a way of dealing with some of those questions or dialogues that you had around identity and possibly race and heritage, once you could express that through your art, there was sort of no stopping you. And that did that in turn give you confidence? Is that a fair assessment, or have I not?
No, I think you're right. I think so. I think when you feel the minority, or you feel like you're different and you're the odd one and you don't perhaps blend in with the masses,
mm-hmm.
you can, and like a lot of my kind of growing up in life, I've been in this mode where I've felt insecure about who I was and insecure and not having that confidence. But also I think there comes a point where that condition doesn't change in your environment, but that realization within you really just, you actually go the other way, and that negativity around you actually has the opposite impact,
yeah.
where you just...
It empowers you
to say, yeah, and what? You know, I'm fed up of being, of that condition that yeah. I was in, and actually now I want to kind of go against the grain, in fact. So nothing yeah. really changed. In fact, actually, I'd say that was continuing, the conditions around me were the same, but
the conditions didn't change, but you did.
Yeah, absolutely, and that actually encouraged me more so to do so. And I still remember an example in school where I was in my school. I wasn't that popular in school monk when it comes to the staff. Let's put it that way. I was a bit of a rebel, but I still remember, because I didn't quite fit the model of yeah. you know being in that school. I remember one member of staff saying to me, you might as well just give up right now. You go on YTS, right? And I told him, I said, I want to work in the games industry. I want to run my own restaurant, right? And I'm going to work, and this is what I'm going to do. He says, you might as well give up now. And I still remember those words.
Yeah.
And that encouraged me to say, you know what, I'm going to, and I did exactly that.
Yeah.
Both of those things.
It can go two ways, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that's...
What also in listening to you talk now about that, it almost seems like a perfect metaphor for your work, because it's something like that which was invisible just becomes very visible and very colourful. So I remember in your TEDx talk, you talked about dull grey concrete walls, you know, that you don't see because they don't stand out. They're blind.
Mm-hmm.
You just become blind to them. That you paint them with colour, you dress them with colour, and suddenly they are transformed and that yeah. becomes visible. And that sort of feels to me a bit like a metaphor for what you're talking about, that whatever those feelings were, you're now making them visible and expressing that through your work and through your art.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, you've said it perfectly.
Just to conclude, just tell us a few things that you've sure. done recently and maybe what you've got coming up.
I've got a lot of international projects that I'm embarking on this year in particular, coming in Malaysia and Australia and the US. But as great as that sounds, you know what? We've got issues on my doorstep here in Birmingham, yeah. right? So so the work's continuing, but I'm particularly right now taking the time out and the focus to try to give back to the city. You know, yeah, mm-hmm. I have to. I feel it's a duty to do so. So there's a number of projects I'm trying to develop, and with a bit of a strategy and a bit of a vision. That's important, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's important as an artist. Sometimes I have to come out of my shoes as this creative that's kind of out there, but actually go, okay, let's look at practical steps of how this can have legacy and actually yeah. be transformative for communities, especially probably more so than ever right now yeah. in difficult times when it comes to faith and religion and yeah. and communities living in you know segregated communities, etc., etc. So there's an art center I'm launching. It's a very intimate space, but it's a space I ran for 3 years previously, but the space was taken because of regeneration in the area. But we're trying to bring that space back because I strongly believe that there, in the societies that we live, and this is probably a project I'm most excited about because I see the need for it so much, not just here in this city, but every city.
Yeah.
The need for neutral spaces, looking for exciting, radical alternative ways of connecting human beings, and I think that in a multi-faith, multicultural society where we see so many complex issues, they're not actually complex, it's not rocket science how we deal with some of these issues. Sometimes I feel like screaming because I see the need for neutral, non-sacred, non-religious spaces where people can convene, have debates and discussions, and do so in exciting, creative, radical new ways, yeah. and that isn't happening. So this space that I'm launching is a continuation of something we did, to be honest with you, and yeah. it was a tried and tested method that worked, that has now gone, and we just I'm
time
excited
right
about
to bring it back.
It's absolutely the right time to bring that back and make people real invest in that as well.
Well, Ahmed, thank you so much for talking to us. The very best of luck with your
you.
Space. It's called The Hub, isn't it?
That's right, The Hub, yeah.
So very, and we look forward to seeing The Hub flourish. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Helga.
Like it or loathe it, we are now in a position where the age of austerity, whether we're still in it or not, we're in a new regime where the sources of funding, the sources of money are not what they used to be. In the past, where it might have been easier to get greater levels of subsidy or charitable funding, that's increasingly difficult in the creative and cultural sector. But I think it's worth remembering that the money hasn't really gone away. The money wasn't taken away in wheelbarrows and burned. The money is still out there, it's just in different places. And we need to cultivate a new set of skills and broker new sets of relationships in order to unlock that money. I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I'm not saying it's not hard work. But we need to think about how we can meet the needs of funders, of suppliers, of customers, and of donors in a whole new way. The arts economy in America has been living like this for some time. And it's true, there's quite a lot of reliance on really high net worth individuals. But, you know, maybe that's what we need to start doing. Looking at relationships with different people, different types of people, and seeing how we can be of benefit and value both ways. When we talk about networking, we always talk about giving value to get value. And it's time to expand our networks and our relationships with a whole variety of people so that we can uncover value for ourselves. So I know that a lot of arts organisations, some smaller businesses, I know there's a struggle, but take comfort in the fact that the money hasn't gone away. It's just somewhere different. And we have the resources, the skills, and the creativity to go out there and find it.
That's all for this time. Thanks for listening to the Creative Shift podcast, recorded in the analogue delights of Highbury Studio. Big shout out to John and our engineer Rob. Tune in next time for more insight, comment, and of course, a rant or two. Bye.